White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 476.
You are listening to the AU Wishbone, almost credible sports discussion on the White Rocket Entertainment Network.
Bye-bye, Bo! Touchdown, Auburn!
The kick is good! Auburn wins! Shivers just ran through a man! Touchdown, Auburn!
Hello and welcome to the AU Wishbone, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with TheWarEagleReader.com and by people like you, the Auburn family, our AU Wishbone family, our Patreon.com family. I'm Van Allen Plexico and I'm joined as always by my co-host.
I'm John Ringer.
John, we have a couple of things to get to tonight. This is, of course, in the newest installment in our ongoing series looking back at interesting games from before we had a podcast. And also, of course, we have to talk a little bit about Pat Dye briefly. And also, there's been a little bit of stuff going on in terms of the team. So why don't we just take a couple of minutes and mention that the team's more or less the players are back on campus. Have you seen that?
Yes, they're back. The SEC allowed student-athletes back starting today officially for workouts today. I think the team came back this weekend.
Yeah.
And they're bringing them on campus and being careful and all that kind of stuff. But basically, they're working out for a few weeks before we move on to fall practice and stuff. So that's good news for those of us who are, you know, hopeful by having a football season.
Yeah, these are the legendary voluntary mandatory summer workouts, mm-hmm. I guess. It sounded like three players, when they screened them, were positive for the virus, which is two fewer than Alabama, but still three too many. But I think that that's just something that they're going to have to accept and find ways to work around. I heard a really interesting point from Formula One this weekend that directly applies to this. They said that when this all started back in early mid-March, Formula One and everybody else, right, immediately said we're canceling, we're postponing, everything comes to a screeching halt for an indefinite period of time. And I feel like while that was necessary, and there may still be things like that necessary in the days to come, I feel like they've kind of, a lot of sports and business have begun to temper that with a sense that, you know, there are possibly ways to go about doing our business that don't drive us bankrupt. And I understand that, right? I mean, I can see both sides of it perfectly clear. So what Formula One said is they're coming back, I think, July 4th. And Formula One said this time, because what happened was some of their team members, I believe a couple of McLaren or Williams guys, like the mechanics, were tested positive, and they just shut the whole sport down, you know, for 3 months. And they said this time when they come back, they expect to find random people positive, and they are not going to shut everything down because of it. They're going to use, you know, isolation techniques and, you know, separate them in hotel rooms or something and for a couple of weeks and all that. So I feel like the mindset on this has slowly changed from where it was in March. And I'm curious to see how that will play with college football. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, I think you're right. But, I mean, it's the mindset, but it's also we know a lot more than we did in
March.
That's true. I mean, it really isn't, you know, a new virus that we're learning stuff about every day. So I think we know a lot more now about mm-hmm. transmission and where it's safe and what kind of activities create more risk and that kind of stuff. So
yeah, that's true. So yeah. So and I saw that Coach Malzahn and the players, some of them went to the Tumors Corner rally where they were singing Amazing Grace and stuff. I thought that was really powerful. It was really fascinating to me to see the Auburn coach and Bruce Pearl, of course. I knew Bruce would go. But it was cool to see Gus, too. I think that Gus has been very interesting to watch his reaction to everything that's been going on in the country, both the virus and the protests and so forth. And I just thought it was really – I don't doubt where the heart of any of our previous coaches were, but I think politically, I don't know if they would have gone. It was interesting to see Gus leading the way, leading the team, right, to that event at Toomer's Corner, I believe, yesterday. So That just profoundly impacted me to show that it's just a different world now, you know. And I have 100%, and we're going to talk about Pat Dye next. I have 100% certainty that Pat Dye didn't have a racist bone in his body and loved his players as much as if they were his own children. I have no doubt about that. Never doubted that. I don't think he would have led players to a protest like that. I just think that not because of him, but because of the politics of the world in the 80s and early 90s were just different. You know what I mean?
Yes.
So it was just interesting to see that and just see how things have changed. Well, what did you think about Coach Dye's passing? You have any thoughts about that?
I mean, it was sad. He was an important historical figure at Auburn and a great coach, and you know, and made all the difference in the world. And think. In the interview I did with David Housel last fall, he talked about this, where he, you know, Pat Dye changed how Auburn people saw themselves.
Yes.
And what was capable for Auburn, what was possible for Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
And that made a lot of difference in, you know, then and now. So I think that's a big legacy. And I think, you know, bringing the game to Auburn, winning the SEC, I think he really laid the foundation for the modern success of Auburn football. And, that's what I think. I'm glad we named the field after him beforehand.
Yeah. Before, yeah. Yeah, I think he definitely raised the expectation level to a height they'd probably never been. And I think that you and I are a little too young to really have to remember the other great semi-modern Auburn era with Coach Jordan in his best years between 57 when he won the national championship and maybe 71 when Pat Sullivan won the Heisman. You know, that 15-year window there was pretty much his golden era. And we kind of missed that. And so for us, Pat Dye is just the gold standard. I mean, we can argue all day who won more this or who won more that, who deserved to win whatever, who should have won or whatever. But just in terms of elevating the entire program to a new level and putting us on a playing field where, I guess I would put it this way, before Pat Dye, Auburn was, Somebody said, without Pat Dye, today Auburn would be about the same as Kentucky or Ole Miss. And there's nothing wrong with that, but we don't see ourselves as on a level with Kentucky or Ole Miss. We see our football program as a higher plateau than them. And it's really because of Pat Dye, because Auburn in 1975, 1980 era, we were like a Kentucky or Ole Miss, where if we got the kind of players that, you know, that they get every once in a while, we might have a 9-3 season. But the thought of being a, you know, SEC champion more than once in 1957, the thought of going to the playoffs and all that, which we demand as our birthright today, wouldn't have even been on the table, I don't guess. I mean, you know, it would have been interesting to see who we would have gotten as a coach in the 80s if not Pat Dye, and what it could have, you know, how it would have gone otherwise. But, he deserves all the – and just as an ambassador for the university and the way that, you know, he – you know. You know, God bless Tommy Tuberville, but when he left Auburn, he had years left in him. He went off and went to Texas Tech, and he went off to Cincinnati and all that. Pat Dye stayed at Auburn and became like the elder statesman of Auburn. He became Mr. Yes. Auburn, just like Charles Yes. Barkley and Bo Jackson, and that's huge.
It is a big thing. Like, he didn't go off and do other things. He retired in Auburn and stayed there.
Stayed there, that's right. So, okay, so the other thing, I guess, is we're going to talk about our main topic tonight, unless I'm forgetting anything, is that we've talked about some big, exciting, gonzo, crazy wins, like the rain game with West Virginia, the Arkansas 2010 game with Cam, the Florida game where they, you know, game-changing performance and all that. But tonight, we're actually going to look at really six games, not in any great depth, but just in general. I did watch them and take some notes just for the sake of having that information if we need it. But I think the main thing we're going to focus on tonight is why these games turned out the way they did, because what do all these games have in common besides Auburn playing in them, John?
They were ties.
Ties, which is something that can't even happen today. So they really have, you know, they really have a strange character to them, as in why? Why did we tie? Why did we have tie games? was there an overall sense of it, or was it particular to each individual game? So we're going to kind of go through these games very briefly and talk about what was the specific situation in each game, why did it end in a tie, and was that a good thing or a bad thing? Because as you said in the notes, there are ties that feel like a win, ties that feel like a loss, and there are ties that feel like a tie. I'm not quite sure what a tie feels like other than kissing your sister. Which Johnny Major said, well, my sister's pretty good looking, so that's okay. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're definitely from Tennessee. anyway, so let's look into it then. Let's dig in. So tell us what the games are we're going to be looking at.
So again, the Division I football introduced the playoff, the overtime system in 1996. Before that time, there could be ties in college football. So we could have gone to a lot of games, but we limited them from kind of the 80s through the early 90s. Mm-hmm. So 1987 Tennessee, 1987 Syracuse.
I love that two of them are in the same year. That's crazy.
The Sugar Bowl. Yeah. 1990 Tennessee.
Two of them are Tennessee.
1992 Arkansas.
First time we played them in the SEC.
1994 Georgia. Tying Georgia. And then we'll have a brief discussion at the end about 96 Georgia.
Which is very significant for a couple of reasons, yes.
Yes.
All right. So Tennessee in 1987, again, just to quickly set the stage, this is Pat Dye and Pat Sullivan. Jeff Berger's the quarterback. This is the 87 team that had all the great receivers like Lawyer Tillman. You had freshman James Joseph. You had Tracy Rocker and Quentin Riggins on the defense. I mean, you know, this was that great 87-88 team, different quarterbacks in those years. But this was the beginning of, 86 was really good, 10-2. But this was a year we really thought we had a national championship team. And we had Win Lyle as our kicker, a walk-on, 18-year-old Win Lyle, beat out three scholarship kickers to go up against to Knoxville, to go up against Johnny Majors in Tennessee with Reggie Cobb, that you and I both love to hate, right?
Oh, God, that guy killed us.
Reggie Cobb, man. And this game, I'm just going to kind of hit some highlights, and then you jump in anything you want. We can talk about it when I'm done. But I just kind of like to go through quickly the setup of each of these games because it's why it played out the way it did in terms of the scores. So in the first half, it was 6-0 Auburn because Win Lyle hit two really long. One of them was 55-yard. I think the other was 52-yard field goals. And so Auburn was up 6-0 at the half, which is not a score you want Pat Dye to sit on if you remember the 88 LSU, the earthquake game. And then because it was completely a defensive struggle in the first half. But in the second half, Tennessee kicked a field goal. We threw an interception. They kicked another field goal. They scored a touchdown. It was 10-6 Tennessee. By the way, Kevin Steele was the Tennessee defensive back coach, I noticed. And then we go on a long drive, and we go up 13-10. This is all in the second half now. We score again to make it 20-10. I remember this game, and when we went up 20-10 in the fourth quarter, I thought it was over. I thought, we're up 20-10. They had that one, moment where they scored a touchdown. Otherwise, I felt like we were closing this game out. But then Alvin Harper, John, just killed us in this game.
Redshirt freshman Alvin Harper.
Wow, yeah. Reggie Cobb and Alvin Harper were the two weapons on this offense. And they were, and I also noted that the run plays in this game, it looked like an Auburn LSU game where they're just killing each other every play. So they kicked a field goal with 7 minutes to go. It's 20-13. And then we end up punting again, and Reggie Cobb is going to run it in, and it's going to be 20-20. The total offense was almost the same, a little over 200 yards each. Cobb ran in for the touchdown, and Johnny Majors with a minute 20 to go goes for one, and they make it, and it's 20-20 with a minute 20 to go. And whoever the announcer was said, it's 2-point conversion time, and I'm like, who are the coaches in this game? You think they're going for two? Neither one of them. So we actually, this is interesting too, because they went for one, because I think, well, we'll talk about why. I think I know why, and I think you probably do too. So it's 20-20. Berger got us all the way down to the Tennessee 43-yard line, 19 seconds to go. We hit Freddie Wagan to the 33 that should stop the clock. That's a first down. But the referee didn't stop the clock, and the clock ran out before he could get off another play. And this was before you could clock the ball, you know, snap it and throw it in the ground. So Berger had to actually try to throw a pass out of bounds, which takes, you know, a few seconds. And by that time, it was over. And Dye was trying to run down the refs to say, why did you let the clock keep running? But they, of course, you know, they're gone faster than Flash versus Quicksilver. So, I mean, and you had to think, I mean, Win Lyle had already kicked a 55-yard field goal in that stadium, you know, in the first half. So if we could have gotten it to, like, the 38, you know, and we were on the 33 when the time ran out. Yeah. All we had to do was stop the clock, and he comes in and kicks a field goal, and we win.
That's right.
So tell me, that's kind of how the game played out. Was that a good win? I mean, a good tie or a bad tie? And why did it come out that way?
I think this is a tie that feels like a loss, because we're winning in the fourth quarter.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the big play that really set Auburn back was Wagan did a bad job in this game on kick returns.
Yeah.
And he tried to return one kickoff, and he's running sideways at like the 3-yard line with the whole Tennessee special teams bearing down. I mean, he got tackled like at the 4. And that, you know, Auburn was pinned deep in its own end late in the fourth quarter and ended up having to punt. And that led to Tennessee getting great field position for the drive where they drove down the field with Reggie Cobb and scored the touchdown. So
yeah,
I blame the kind of poor Auburn special teams for putting us in that position. And then, you know, the clock thing was crap. I mean, it is very different to watch games back then in terms of how the clock and the clock stoppages and stuff were handled. It was a different world, and it was very much a home cooking kind of operation.
Yeah. Hey, imagine that. Tennessee getting some home cooking from the refs in their own stadium. I can't even fathom that such a thing could happen. I mean, it's like 85, the ambush, or 89 when they had the sprinklers on to make the rain extra rainy. I mean, that's that's what they do. Johnny Majors, if there was one thing Johnny Majors was good at, it was stacking the deck in his favor when he was the home team. Some way. He would find a way. I mean, I'm surprised he didn't dig like Vietnamese, you know, tiger traps with spikes and hide them over with leaves on the field so that when Auburn got the ball, we'd fall in a tiger trap or something, you know. It's just, he was really, so why did he go for one?
I think because, you have to think about this. If you weren't alive during that time and you weren't used to these kind of games, playing for the tie was seen as like, getting the tie was better than a loss. So there were times when, you know, the coach's calculation was if the tie was, you know, a high chance of a tie and a low chance of getting the win, they'd go for the tie. And,
yeah,
and coaches were okay with playing for the tie.
Well, and particularly back then, because we played Tennessee always so early in the season, and there was some kind of streak where the loser of that game never won the SEC or even got to play for it. Never came close. And so Majors and Dye both said, if I can get out of here with a tie, it's not as good as a win, but it the season is still alive. Whereas if you lose that Tennessee game, either team, it's like the season's half over already. You know, it's like you might as well just play for second place now or something. So I think that was in the calculus. Oh, one other thing I want to note about these ties. I was kind of looking at the list here because think about this. You know, who is responsible for the tie? In 87, it was Tennessee was responsible. In the Syracuse game, Auburn was responsible. In the 90 Tennessee game we're going to get to in a minute, I think it was us that were responsible. In the 92 Arkansas game, if I recall correctly, there was not a video copy of this one available, but I read a transcript of it. And I think you may have too. And if I recall correctly, it's one of those where we were tied with a lot of time to go and just neither team scored. And so it's not like either team, it's not like the last play of the game, you know, became a tie. It was a tie.
It wasn't an intentional tie. They both just kind of ran out of time.
Right. And with 94 Georgia, it was that Ray Goff decided to tie it and then we still could have won and we missed the kick, which we'll get to. So, That was the ending of that one is the weirdest. We're kind of, which is kind of fortunate. It's the last one. Okay, I recently rewatched the Syracuse Sugar Bowl from '87, and so I didn't watch it again this last week because I watched it about a month ago. Oops, sorry. I watched it about a month ago. Oh, for God's sake. Windows is just starting to tell me all this stuff. And I really couldn't watch it again. I just couldn't sit through it again. But here's my recollections of it. And you correct me or fill in what you want. I'll just very quickly say it was, again, another one of these bowl games. It's a fairly low-scoring affair. Very similar in some ways to the Oregon-Cam National Championship game in a way, you know, where one would get ahead for a little bit, the other would come back, and it kind of stayed tied all the way along in the teens and the 20s, you know. And it came down really to we scored, I think, one touchdown. They scored a touchdown maybe. And it was 16-13 Syracuse. And we drove down to, like, their 10-yard line. And it was, and every time we threw the ball to Lawyer Tillman, they would interfere with him and the referee wouldn't call it. They were just hanging all over him. And so Pat Dye said, well, there's no point throwing the ball in the end zone to my receivers because they're going to get interfered with and it's not going to get called. So, and that pass interference bedeviled us in the Sugar Bowl that year and the next year, by the way, famously. Yes. And so Dye is just kind of like, forget it. If I can't score a touchdown, I'm just going to kick the field goal and walk on out of here. And so he just, when we got down there with like 1 second to go, he kicked the dang field goal. And 16-16 was the final score. And their coach, Don McPherson, Don was the quarterback. I can't remember the
Dick.
Dick, yeah. Dick and Don. Oh, very appropriately named. Dick McPherson was furious and didn't even shake hands, kind of slapped Dye's hands, and Dye cracked up laughing. So what do you make out of that? I mean, that was just Pat Dye kind of on the spur of the moment making a decision that, by golly, he wanted to tie the game rather than lose, right?
Right, but the stakes were different for the two teams. This is part of it. Syracuse was undefeated, I believe.
Yes, they were playing for the, in their minds, they were playing for the national championship, even though there were also like three other big teams that were undefeated ahead of them, so it wasn't going to happen.
They weren't going to win it, but in their minds, they wanted a share of it, right?
Yes.
And so, you know, they were a good team. They had a, you know, good offense and some good players. It was an evenly matched game, and Auburn drove down the field at the end, and again, there were some, watching it in hindsight, there's a lot of clock management stuff at the end of that game, but you're right, there was a lot of passes in the sideline to Lawyer Tillman and stuff that were, you know, they were kind of all over him, and I think Dye felt like, I didn't want the players to lose, we made it here, mm-hmm. we won the SEC, we got back to the Sugar Bowl after, you know, 4 years since 83, and he didn't want the players to go out losing after they had fought so hard. So he, you know, we basically ran out of time at the end and kicked the field goal and felt like, you know, that was good. The other thing about these games is games back then were lower scoring. And so when you have lower scoring games and the possibility of a tie, there's more likely to be a tie, right?
Yeah.
When you have like a defensive struggle kind of a game. So, mm-hmm. And that was kind of what happened here. It was two teams playing good defense and, you know, kicking field goals so Syracuse was very upset about it. Mm-hmm. Dye went for the tie and we got it and they were mad about it and their coach said stuff about it and all their fans mailed Pat Dye ties.
Yeah.
And he autographed them and sold them for charity.
That was great. And then we sent a bunch of sour grapes to Syracuse.
Yes. So, but no, I mean, so to me, okay, so to you, is that a tie that feels like a win, a loss, or a tie?
Tie. I think I didn't know what you meant, a tie that feels like a tie, until you just described this game just then. And I'm like, yeah, it felt like a tie because I imagine to Syracuse it almost felt like a loss, which made them even madder than if they lost.
View this tie as a loss, yes, 100%.
Yeah, but I don't feel like we view it as a win because we wanted to win and we didn't get to win. And so we didn't get what we wanted and they didn't get what they wanted. I think they were more disappointed by far than we were. We walked out of that game kind of going, and they walked out going, I hate Auburn. Auburn is the devil, you know. So it definitely was worse for them. I'd rather be us. It's more win than loss for us, but I think it still felt like a tie for us. Would you concur?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was the 50th Sugar Bowl, by the way. That was interesting. That it was weird. The thing that struck me about that game is I knew Syracuse was undefeated, but I also knew where they played, right? I mean, they hadn't played hardly anybody. And so I didn't value them as highly as I guess I should. They were actually a pretty darn good team. They had a really good quarterback, McPherson, Don. And they had some pretty good players. And, I mean, clearly they were able to limit us to just 16 points. So, yeah, we didn't score a rushing touchdown either one of these Sugar Bowls, 87 or 88. So hats off to them on that. I was going to mention two things real quick. It was either that team or I guess it was the 90 Tennessee team, either the 87 Tennessee or 90 Tennessee, that tied Auburn and already had a tie against, like, UCLA. And
yes.
And so they had two ties before. I mean, we had two ties in 87, but the second one came at the very end of the year. Tennessee had two ties in like their first four games. That's just weird, man. That just struck me as strange that they tied twice. I have to mention Florida. I'd forgotten about this until just a second ago. The 1990 Florida State game in some ways is kind of the bookend to that 87 Syracuse game, and I'll tell you why. It might not be really apparent if you don't remember the exact details of how that game played out. The 90 Florida State game was a game where Florida State was ahead and Auburn came back. I want to say they were ahead like 17-10 in the fourth quarter. This is the game that you and I were at with all of our friends, and when it was over, we had the giant group hug and fell down like half the section. All the people fell down like two sections. But this was a game where I think Florida State was up 17-10 late in the fourth quarter, and we scored a touchdown with like 2 minutes to go, and Pat Dye kicked the extra point to make it 17-17. And we were all kind of like, oh, here we go again. It's Syracuse again. Dye's playing for the tie. And we're like, I don't know. Are we mad about this? Are we okay with it? I'm not sure. But then, of course, Florida State came out, and we either stopped them really quickly with timeouts or we got a turnover. This may be where they – remember, I think it was like either Casey Weldon or one of those.
Did he get a big sack on him?
Huge. Like he stumbled and fell 20 yards. He started stumbling and stumbled 20 yards backwards and fell down on his side of the field. Yeah. So we got the ball back and went down and kicked the field goal and won 20-17. And, of course, we were elated to beat Florida State and win game seven of the series, as it were, you know, which it was, 4-3. The series went our way after that. Of the 80s and early 90s, but the thing about it was, because we won, everybody kind of forgot that less than 2 minutes earlier it had been 17-17, and it could have very well ended in a tie. And I always wondered, what would people have said if we hadn't gotten that ball back and kicked that field goal? Dye said, I thought I'd get the ball back, right? And I always thought, well, if you thought you'd get the ball back, what difference did it make whether we were tied or down one or up one? You know what I mean? Just go for two, and if you don't make it, you get the ball back. What difference does it make? But everybody kind of accepted that, and I never understood that.
Again, back then with the potential of a tie, you have like this safety net to get the ball back. So
I guess that's it. Yeah, you think – I always felt like Pat Dye thought about ties a little funny. I don't know. I mean, it worked out more often than not, but it just – I don't know. I just never understood his logic. Well, anyway, all right, our next one up. 1990 Tennessee. This was one of Stan White's very first games as, I believe, a redshirt freshman at quarterback. We were ranked number 3. Tennessee, I guess, already had a tie and was ranked number 5. And it was in Auburn. And I remember did we see this one together? I think we did.
Yeah, we were together in this game. But it's funny. I watched this game again, and I knew I was there, but I did not remember this game. I remember a lot of the games that we saw in person. I did not remember this one in particular.
I have that happen sometimes, but I remember this one fairly well. I have a very vivid recollection of a Tennessee fan throwing a bottle or a wadded-up cup at their kicker and hitting him in the head after the game. I have a vivid recollection of that. So I did remember this one pretty much. So this was... let's see. This was again the same Auburn team that played in. I mean, no, this was the 1990. So a lot of that 87, 88, 89 team was gone. You had Stan White taking over at quarterback over Reggie Slack. You had Ed King at offensive line. You still had James Joseph and Stacey Danley, kind of mainstays. This was their last year. But we were bringing in Tony Richardson and Daryl Electron Williams. And the receivers, man, this is Shane Wazin, Herb the Weapon Casey. Greg Taylor was a good one. Dale Overton had a big game in this game. Pedro Cherry, I think, was a freshman. We had two big tight ends, Fred Baxter and Victor Hall. Those were great guys. We had a lot of weapons on offense that year. And the defense was very solid with David Rocker. So I never understood why the 1990 team struggled as much as they did, especially later in the season, when they had so many good players on this team, you know?
I think, like, that group of receivers, I think, is good, but I don't think they're special.
That's true. It's not Lawyer Tillman and...
It's not 2005.
Freddie Wiggin. Or the 2-5 team, that's for sure. But they were still very serviceable weapons for Stan to throw to, and you had a good backfield there. Especially Tony Richardson. He was no fooling a good back. Well, this was Andy Kelly's team with Johnny Major still as a coach and Tony Thompson at running back. I noted he took a break from playing drums for the Power Station to play running back for Tennessee. And this is the team that had Alvin Harper again and Anthony Morgan. So this was a good – now these are some good right wide receivers. Can I get an amen?
Amen. And Tennessee went through a period where they were kind of the wide receiver U. They were producing wide receivers in the NFL every year. And this was kind of the big part of that, or maybe the beginning of that. And they had Dale Carter on defense. He was a stud.
He's a good one. Yeah, they were kind of doing the receiver thing before LSU did, you know? It's like LSU took over for them being receiver U for a while there. Auburn was down, but we were still really good. And so this game went really weird. Let me run through this one really quick, the 90 Tennessee. I know that the entire first quarter was played basically in Auburn's red zone. We kept turning the ball over, both teams. Neither team had any offense. We really had become a pass-first team. Pat Sullivan was calling all the plays. And we were throwing the ball on first down. But we had 1.4 yards on first down. But Tennessee turned the ball over four times by midway through the second quarter to keep us in it. So it was kind of a ugly defensive struggle. Alvin Harper went 82 yards for a touchdown the second quarter. They went for two and didn't make it. It was 12-0 Tennessee. And then on the next drive, James Joseph fumbles in our own red zone. Tennessee scores. It's 19-0. So at 19-0, I remember sitting there in the stadium thinking, oh, my gosh, we're going to get killed by Tennessee. This game is already over. We had nothing going on offense. We were helping them out, and only their turnovers were even keeping it from being like 30-something to nothing at this point, right?
Yes.
So we do get a field goal. It's 19-3 at the half. Late in the third quarter. So,
let's be clear. At halftime, when it's 19-3 and we played like crap, every Auburn fan in that stadium would have taken a tie.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because we thought it's going to end up being 38-6. I mean, you know, this is not good. But Greg Taylor has a good touchdown. They go for two and don't make it. I noted if we'd kicked the extra point here, we won the game.
Yes.
You know me, John. I have said forever.
Yep.
Don't go for two unless you have to. Now, I did flirt. I will admit, I flirted with the whole go for it in completely unexpected circumstances that Chip Kelly did and that Gus did for 5 minutes until it didn't work. But see, that's different. When you do it at the beginning of the game, I think that's Chip Kelly's rationale. If you do it at the beginning of the game, nobody's expecting it. When you do it in like the second or third quarter, but at a point where everybody does expect it, it never works. You either do it early when nobody expects it, or you do it late when you have to. But in between, never, never, never do it. Oh my gosh, don't do it. So it's 19-9 Tennessee. We block a field goal, but they call roughing the kicker, even though we blocked the kick. So I thought if you block the kick, it's not roughing the kicker, and the crowd booed and everything. But so on the very next play, Tennessee scores a touchdown. So it's 26-9 at the beginning of the fourth quarter. What are your thoughts when it's 26-9 Tennessee to start the fourth quarter and the referees aren't helping us out at home?
Well, I mean, that call in the block kick was crap. And no, I think we were in big trouble there. And it's 26-9, and it's raining at this point.
Yeah. Oh, God. So that's not a good combination.
You imagine you're at an Auburn home game where it's 26-9 at night, and we're losing to Tennessee, and our best player on offense gets a leg injury and leaves the game, Ed King.
Ed King, yeah.
And it's pouring down rain.
So then Greg Taylor catches a pass, gets into the Tennessee red zone and fumbles, and you're like, oh, this is just one thing after another. But Shane Wazza comes in and recovers it, and we get a field goal. So it's 26-12 with 11 minutes to go. So we're still down two touchdowns with 11 minutes to go. It doesn't look good. Interestingly enough, this is kind of the reverse of how the Georgia game I'm going to talk about in a minute played out. So Tennessee keeps stopping the clock. I have a note. Is this Johnny Majors or Curly Holman? They keep throwing incomplete passes and running out of bounds.
Not go down in history as a great job of clock management.
No. So we get a fourth. I said there's so much drama here. We get a fourth down conversion. Then we have an interception, but it's called back. And then James Joseph runs in for a touchdown on fourth down, but there's a penalty called back. And finally, Dale Overton catches a touchdown on fourth down, and it's 26-19 Tennessee with 8 minutes to go. I noted that in the second half, Andy Kelly was 1 for 6 for 5 yards. So wow. You can't really say Johnny Majors completely embraced his inner Curly Holman, but he wasn't helping things out there, stopping the clock. I mean, it was pouring down rain. Yeah, I didn't remember the rain. You noted that it was raining, and I'm like, I remember being there, but I don't remember the rain. Maybe that affected that kick at the end. So we come down again on fourth down, and Greg Taylor catches another touchdown. He had a good game. Overton and Taylor had good games. I like Greg Taylor. And yeah. He wore the 16 before Damian Craig. And Tennessee comes down as the clock expires, and Burke tries a 34-yard field goal that you and I both, I know, thought he was going to make, right? We thought we were about to lose the game. You don't miss a 34-yard field goal to win the game unless you're Matt Hawkins, but we'll get to him in a minute. So he misses, and Tennessee fans start pelting him with trash. Stan takes a knee on the last few seconds. Instead of trying to go down and kick a field goal, was 12 seconds enough? Again, you couldn't clock the ball back then.
Yes. No, I mean, you'd like to, again, it's 12 seconds. Throw the ball down the field.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering about that. I'm sure Herbert the Weapon Casey was like, throw it to me. I'm the weapon, haven't you heard? So 26-26 was the final. I noted this was Tennessee's second tie in first 5 games. They tied Colorado. By the way, that's the Colorado team that goes on to share the national championship despite having 2 ties and a loss and the 5th down game. I've always said the 2007 LSU team is the biggest joke of a national championship because they lost like 2 games, right? Both in overtime, but who cares? It's still they lost them both. But this Colorado game lost 2 games and tied 2 games and won the national championship. Huh? So whatever. This was Auburn's second tie with Tennessee in 4 years again. We end up 8-3-1 and 5th in the SEC. Tennessee 9-2-2 and end up 2nd behind Florida, was on probation. So, of course, Tennessee gets to go to the Sugar Bowl and beat Virginia, who had been number 1. I just thought it was interesting how this all played out. Tennessee's only losses that year were to Alabama and number 1 Notre Dame. So and they beat Virginia that had been number 1 part of the year. So this was a really good Tennessee team, you know, even though they're 9-2-2. They lost to a number 1 team. They beat a former number 1 team. They lost to Alabama because it's the law. And they tied the national champion. And they tied us. So we're in pretty good darn company there, right?
Oh, yeah. And again, this was definitely a tie that felt like a win.
Yes.
We were down big, and it was a really good team, and we came back against them. So and they kind of choked it, you know, at the end of the field goal. So.
And it's also one where it really didn't matter that we went for 1 and tied it because they were going to come down and win it anyway if they made that field goal or a score of some kind. In other words, they were going to get the last word in the conversation. And so us tying this game is not like Syracuse. In the Syracuse game, we got the last word in the conversation, and our word was tie. In this game, we said, all right, we're going to pull even with you. Now let's see what you can do. And maybe you'll throw an interception, a pick 6. You know, maybe you'll fumble. And their response was they missed a field goal, so which is, again, the exact opposite of how the Georgia game is going to play out. So it felt like a win, and it wasn't as much our tie as the Syracuse game, right?
That's right. I mean,
we scored last to make it a tie, but with time still on the clock. So, okay. All right. Let's see. Quickly about Arkansas 92. I'm not going to go through all the details in this game. It was really a meaningless game. There were really two things of note about this.
Again, so meaningless, you cannot find video.
I'm not sure it actually happened.
I think it's been scrubbed.
It's been erased from reality. This is a game that Auburn led 12-0, but then... Arkansas led 12-0. So I kind of feel like, in a way, that's kind of a good tie, right, that we came back and tied it. But then we took a 13-12 lead. This is what kills me. I will note this. We went up 13-12, and if we were about to score again, we were on the Arkansas 15, about to score again and make it 20-12, when Stan throws an 85-yard pick six that made it 18-13 Arkansas.
Yeah, that was the game.
Ugh.
The other part was Arkansas just wasn't that good. This was the year they fired their coach after the first game and put in interim coach Joe Kunz. And so it was kind of die in his last year against interim coach Joe Kunz. And I just, that's the part that makes it frustrating.
So the notable things about this game is the first time we played Arkansas other than in a bowl game, right? This was the first year of the split SEC, the 12 teams, and it was a tie. James Bostic had his best game of his career, 211 yards and two touchdowns. And Bo Jackson, the main thing was that Bo Jackson was on, his jersey was retired at halftime. They'd waited from 85 to 92 when he was pretty much done with his pro career to retire 34. And so Pat Sullivan and Terry Beasley were there, who also had retired jerseys, and they retired Bo's jersey. I had been wondering for years, when are they ever going to retire his jersey? Because you knew they would. And then I realized, they were waiting for his baseball and football pro careers to end, and then he came back. So that was how that played out. Okay, so I'm trying to see. Arkansas was up 21-13. We had a 53-yard drive. We had a two-point conversion to tie it at 21. Okay. And then, like I said, it played out. There was a lot more stuff left. We kicked a field goal.
But again, like you said earlier, both teams got the ball at the end of the game several times in the fourth quarter and couldn't get into field goal range.
So I think this one felt like a tie, right? Because neither team – it's not like either team chose the tie. It just played out that way.
Yes.
All right.
And they were kind of two mediocre teams, mediocre.
Yeah, very. Yeah, that's right. We ended up 5-5-1 that year, so not losing this game kept Pat Dye from ending his career with two losing seasons. So I guess there's that. It's hard to imagine that Pat Dye's last winning season was 1990. That was like, because we were 5-6 in 91 and 5-5-1 in 92. Man. For the longest time, the last bowl game we played in was that Peach Bowl against Indiana in 1990. So, okay, the last tie we're going to look at, the last Auburn tie overall, was 1994 Georgia. This is the game where Terry Bowden's streak finally of winning, not losing, but winning, finally came to an end. Auburn was 20-0. Now, that's important. Think about that. Auburn was on a streak at this point that included the 93 Florida game, the 93 Alabama game, the 94 LSU interception game, and the 94 Florida game. Those were all games Auburn had won without losing a single game going back to the 92 Iron Bowl until Georgia in 94, which was not a good Georgia team. So how does this even happen?
And it was at home.
Yeah. Yeah, it was at home.
So, I mean, again, there was a Georgia team with a lot of good players. And I think, like you said, it was kind of the opposite of the game we just talked about. Auburn got ahead, and then in this game, Auburn got up big. This was Ray Goff was the Georgia coach, and Eric Zeier was the quarterback. They had Terrell Davis at running back.
Eric Zeier, man. He worked my last nerve. Georgia's made a reputation out of having quarterbacks that just tick off Auburn people. I don't like any Georgia quarterback. They're always annoying. Well, maybe Buck Ballou is pretty cool, but after him, every dang Georgia quarterback has been a jerk.
But no, we got up by 2 touchdowns in the game, and then Zaire hits a long pass. You know, they come back, they get the, you know, they drive down and throw another short TD pass and tie the game up, you know, late in the game. Nobody can move the ball. They get called grounding. So they have to punt to us with about a minute to go. We start at our own 38. And at this point, what you were just talking about, this is a team that believed they were going to win. And the fans believed they were going to win. And we started at our 38, and they rolled right down the field, you know, to the 27-yard line to set up the field goal.
Which should have been a lock. I mean, that's what we did back then. We found a way to win every week.
And Matt Hawkins missed it.
And Terry Bowden made the field goal, the touchdown signal, and then he dropped his hands on his hat and did the surrender cobra in one smooth move. I remember him after the game saying, "I just couldn't understand it because we win those games. We make those kicks. I just don't get it, you know." And I remember Ray Goff saying, "You don't just win." In other words, no team just wins all the time. Eventually you lose. And, well, we didn't lose. We tied. Yeah. And now the interesting thing was Georgia came out after that missed field goal and started throwing the ball, and we intercepted them and almost did a hook and ladder back the other way. It was touchy for a minute there. So this definitely feels like a loss, right?
Yes, 100%. I mean, because we won 20 games in a row and then we didn't win.
Yeah.
So it really feels like a loss.
I believe this is the one where the Columbus Inquirer headline said, Georgia beats Auburn 23-23.
Yes.
And there were a couple of things that came out of it. One thing that went into it, I've always felt bad about this, is that the afternoon before that game, I went to, I want to say, Niffer's. And when it was still brand new, and I had a Red Dog beer. Remember those? Red Dog. And I thought, man, I jinxed us with that. I shouldn't have had the Red Dog. I totally ruined everything.
Oh, the truth comes out.
I've never hidden it. I've always said I regret drinking that dang Red Dog beer on that day. The other thing was, I remember we were going to play Alabama. They were undefeated, right? The Iron Bowl was going to be 2 undefeated teams. And then we tied Georgia. And I remember when I got to Legion Field for the 94 Iron Bowl, there was like a big red pickup truck. And in the back window, it said, Auburn, dial 911, meaning we were going to be 9-1-1, right? And somebody else had a 10-0 versus 10-0, and they'd scratched through one of the 10-0s and put 9-0-1. And it just made me mad, you know. That's why they do it, to make us mad. But it just made me mad to realize that missing that dang field goal against Georgia meant that we weren't going to be undefeated and Alabama was. And that just truly ticked me off. Any other thoughts about that game?
No, just, again, the end of the streak made it really frustrating.
It really did.
I didn't want the streak to go out that way.
No. Yeah, the streak should have ended. Well, I mean, it shouldn't have even ended the next week because we should have gotten that first down and gone down. And that would have been interesting. Would we have gone for 2 against? Talking about some hypotheticals. If we'd gotten that first down, if Frank Sanders had been spotted where he really was, and we had gone down and like Damian Craig had punched it in again from the goal line for the third time in a row, or Fred Beasley had run it in or whatever, and it's 21-20 Alabama with no time left, would Terry Bowden have gone for 2?
I think so. What do you think?
Yeah, I think he would. I feel like, I might have put Damian in there instead of Patrick Nix and just told him, run out wide, and if you can run, run, and if you see somebody open, throw it to him. I remember at the end of that game, we'd been using the little flare pass to Fred Beasley out of the backfield a lot, very successfully. You know, it was, I've said all along that the 94 Alabama game was very, very, very much like last year's Georgia, where the other team got out to a 21-0 lead early and we couldn't do anything. And then in the fourth quarter, we suddenly find one play that works and we just do that all the way down the field and score twice and we're on our way to scoring a third time when it stops. That's exactly how both of those games played out. Exactly. It's like Bo Nix has gotten to act out the 94 Alabama game and the 93 Alabama game, you know, when he hit the guy against Oregon, hit Seth, both of them in the same year. It's crazy. And so I'm hoping he gets the 94 Florida game this year against somebody. It won't be obvious against Florida. But anyway, yeah, I felt like if we could have kept hitting Fred Beasley out of the backfield in that little flare pass, we could have scored. And I think he would have gone for two. And if we had done it, we'd have been 22-0 if that had all played out that way. Would we have been awarded the national championship by anybody at 22-0 over two seasons?
I'd like to think so, but I'm not, you know, I don't know.
I don't know.
We beat good teams.
Yeah, we did. Well, the thing is, in 93, we were the only undefeated team. Yeah. But in 94, you had Penn State and Nebraska that were both really, really good. I mean, there was an undefeated Penn State team that didn't win the national championship that year.
Yes.
So I don't know if they would have jumped us over a non-probation-ridden Penn State that also went undefeated. So anyway, just it was a bad year. You know, we always have bad luck with the years as well as with everything else. You know, LSU gets a year where they, again, where they lose two games and they're like the best thing they can, you know, people look around like, okay, well, who's the national champion? I guess it's that crappy LSU team. You know, we could put, we roll undefeated teams out there and they're like, oh, no, there's other teams we could pick. We'll pick Miami. You know, we'll pick Oklahoma, USC, you know, what's what happens? We always get the year where we get screwed. Let me see. I wanted to wrap things up tonight with the 96 Georgia game just very quickly because it would have been a tie, more or less. But before I do that, we got to thank the patrons. The reason we're able to do shows like this, and by the way, I got a lovely new table, little cheap but really nice table here. From IKEA today to put all my monitors and all the computer equipment, everything, the microphone and all that, the stuff that I use to produce all of our shows here. So I appreciate that. That's the little that's the patrons at work there too. I was very frugal about it, but I needed something better than a little rickety card table, and so now I got a pretty decent you know IKEA table. Got to thank our patrons that make stuff like that possible, as well as all of our other expenses. For as little as $1 a month, you can be part of the show, part of our family, and get thanked every dang episode, as I'm about to do. Just go to www.auwishbone.com and click on the big orange button that says Become a Patron. We appreciate it. Join the ranks and come join the fun. We have to thank Matthew Flowers, Carl Von Drunker, Samuel Salvatore, and Christopher Burleson, as well as Phil Amthor, Ben Spooner, Bart Lindsay, Bradley Blackman, William Glenn Matthews, Gary Grant, Brian Gray, Willie Carden, Tom Anderson, Susan Trawick, Logan Chilton, Stephen Thompson, Chris Usher, Steve Trawick, and Richard Stevens. And then, of course, we got William Morgan, Johnny Caldwell, Emmanuel Seaman, WDE Richie, Winston Boddy, Clinton Stewart, and Christopher Stewart. Hey, guys. Mickey B., Phil Davis, Joshua Corbett, John Otsuki, Preston Settle, Daniel Odom, AU Falling Up Alchemist, Kevin Smith, Clarence Alford, Will Summerford, David Hegler, Theodore Gary, Reynolds Wolf, Joel Beckham, Valiant Hermes, Jacob and Robin Fleming, Clay Henson, Ann Kanjian, Catherine England, George Gaston, John McCune, David Evers, Timothy, Steve Harlan, Dan Thompson, Wes Atkinson, and Rich Reimer. Then we have Sarah Hines, Darris Benton, a couple of new folks, welcome aboard, Rob Morgan, Blake Heron, Hugh Anderson, Stephen Houston, Cato the Barner, Danny Flack, Papa Todd, Russell Milling, Kevin Kenoy, Don Zederman, Ross, Lane Middleton, Shannon Butson, Randall Walker, Shane Bailey, Chris Thrash, Tony Perry, Alex Wynn, Josh Teal, David Simpson, Earl Ricks, Mike Finley, and C.T. Wayne. And finally, good old Jeremy Minton, Wardam Wade, Spanky, J.W. Rice, Jason Albrick, Mick Vigicana, Russell Souther, I've said these names a million times and I still mess them up, Paul Bankson, Joseph Iliff, Justin Bean, Kevin Mahan, Stephen Wyatt, see if you fast forward through this, you miss all the fun, Trevor Johnson, Auburn Elvis, Robert Drain, Brandon Smith, Royce Alvarez, Thomas Brinson, David Smiley, Matthew Wagstaff, Donnie Reynolds, Wade Carson, Ivor Evans, John Zavachin, Michael Morton, Lawrence Kane, Darren Pyle. I'm sure nobody fast forwards through it. You want to hear all my wacky mispronunciations. Chris Camo, Ben Amos, Ruth and Darren Sutherland, Patrick Williams, Stephen Schuster, James Taylor, John Stubbs, Kenneth Brent Raines, Nicholas Craig, Joseph A. Miller, Mark Squire, Chris Brant Rumble, our one-time and anonymous donors, And we thank you all. We really appreciate you. We couldn't do it literally without you. Go to www.auwishbone.com. All right. And now, finally, I wanted to mention the 96 Georgia game because it's a very frustrating game. It would have been a tie, but the SEC had just introduced overtime that season, and this was the first SEC game. Of course, it's fitting that it would be Auburn and Georgia, right? The oldest rivalry in the Deep South, right? So, of course, we played the first, the oldest overtime game in the Deep South. What are your memories about that game, John?
Well, I just remember it was bonkers because we had never experienced overtime before, and the whole experience was, you know, traumatic.
Oh, God.
It was so exciting, but it was also just, I remember this game in particular, it was just exhausting.
Yes.
Like, and on and on and on.
Didn't it end like 56-49 or something?
It was 56-49.
Jeez.
This was, you know, both teams rolled up and down the field in overtime. But this, again, Auburn was ahead 28-14.
We were ahead 28-7 in the second quarter.
Yeah, we were up 28-7. They scored again in the second quarter, and then it was 28-14. They scored 14 unanswered points in the fourth quarter of this game. Zaire got hot. This Georgia team had Hines Ward on it, and Hines Ward absolutely barbecued us that day. He had like 175 yards receiving and like 60 yards rushing. And I think I didn't see him in the quarterback thing, but I think some of those runs were him playing like option quarterback.
And yeah, he was kind of the wildcat at that time, yeah.
And so they came back and, you know, and then in overtime – they scored 28 points and we scored 21 points. So it's a lot of scoring in overtime. It was a lot of and there was no field goals in this game.
Yeah.
Zero.
That's amazing. I didn't think about that. Yeah. Including overtime.
Yes. And this game is also very famous for the image of Robert Baker scoring a touchdown and almost getting bit by the Georgia Bulldog
mascot. Stupid dog. Ugh. Yeah, I was going to say, I remembered that it was in this game that happened. I had forgotten that the dog tried to bite him when he was walking into the end zone catching the first touchdown of the game. So that made it stung a little bit less. I thought it was like a sideline play around the 50-yard line, but it was actually Ugga was right off the end zone in the corner, and Baker caught the ball and went out of bounds as he scored the touchdown and went right into Ugga, and Ugga just snapped at him, and it became one of the things that Georgia fans love more than anything else in life. And I don't blame them. I mean, if one of our Eagles had swooped down and tried to kill their coach or something, I'd want a glossy 8x10 of it on my wall, you know. So I get it. I understand. It just kind of sucks for us. But the other thing that was really traumatic about this game, and by the way, this game started in broad daylight in the afternoon, and by the time it was over, I got home, I remember, after 3 a.m. I remember looking at my wife at the time there in that game and saying, I hate to admit this, it's even worse than the Red Dog in 94, and I apologize to you, John, and to the Auburn family. I was so worn out and mentally and emotionally exhausted. It got to be like midnight, and this game was still going on, it seemed like. And I looked at my wife, and I said, I'm about to the point. I don't care if we win or lose. I just want to go home. Because I knew that I still had like a 3.5-hour drive through Auburn traffic and Atlanta traffic to get to Gwinnett County on the other side of Atlanta from, as you well know, right? I mean, when you drive from Auburn to there, getting to Atlanta is like the halfway point. Then you got to cross Atlanta and go all the way back out the other side, which seems the size of Pluto, you know, at that point. So, the moment that made this game was that we sacked Bobo, their quarterback, Mike Bobo. We sacked him
future Georgia offensive coordinator.
So. That's right, and head coach at some places, right? We sacked him on our 30 with 6 seconds to go, and they didn't have any timeouts. The game is over. But what happened? Do you remember?
I'm sorry, set me up again?
We sacked Bobo. They didn't have any timeouts left. The game should have been over, but what did we do?
Did we get a penalty?
Yes. An Auburn player
hit the ball. Then a guy grabbed the ball or something.
An Auburn defensive lineman, I forget who, like picked up the ball and handed it to the referee. So he blew the whistle and stopped the clock. and gave them another play, and they threw a bomb for a touchdown.
Yes.
We'd have still won 28-21 if we hadn't touched the ball. But because he touched the ball, they got a free play and scored a touchdown, and then it went from 28-21 to 56-49. They scored, let's see, they went from, in the last 6 seconds plus overtime, they went from 21 to 56. They scored five touchdowns after there were 6 seconds to go in the game. How crazy is that? They scored that many.
It was insane. I mean, it was, and again, we had the ball last. The last overtime, they scored first. We got the ball last. We could not get a first down. And it was like fourth and three.
Yeah.
Damien Craig ran and got 2 yards and got tackled.
And that was it. Because we had scored touchdowns the previous three times we had the ball in overtime.
Yep.
And we just couldn't make it happen. Yeah, that's the funny thing. If we had scored a touchdown there, it would have been 56-56, and we would have gone to a fifth overtime. Were there four? I think we played four. Yeah. So it wouldn't have even been, if we'd scored there, we wouldn't have won. It would have just been another overtime. Oh my gosh. I'd have jumped off the back of the deck. And you know what's crazy was the next season that we got that insane overtime game between, was it Ole Miss and Arkansas, that just went on and on even worse than this?
Like seven overtimes.
Oh, good Lord. Yeah, that was the one where after that they said you have to go for two after the second touchdown. Mm. Yeah, which was a desperately needed rule change. They hadn't really thought about how it was going to go.
That game was so long, there was real danger players getting injured.
Yeah. Yeah. So my question was, if there hadn't been overtime, would Jim Donnan have gone for two after that last play? Or would he have just kicked the extra point and it would have been a tie?
I think he'd have kicked the extra point. What do you think?
I'm 50-50 on it. I don't remember Donnan well. I think he might have gone for two. I don't know. He might have. Donnan wasn't Johnny Majors. You know what I mean? I mean, he might have gone for two. I'd like to ask him that.
And the other thing is, like, they finished come into the game, they were 4-5, we were 7-3.
Yeah, that's true.
So there's some incentive. When you have a losing record, like, why not go for it, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I like Jim Donnan as a broadcaster and commentator. I kind of enjoy him. I'd like to have a conversation with him and say, kind of, what was your thought process here? What would you have done? What do you think you would have done? So, well, anyway, do we have any listener questions for this episode?
No, I'm sorry. I did not get a chance to collect them.
Okay, no problem. Well, we've kind of gone through everything. But if we're going to continue doing these, do send us your suggestions for what we might do in the future, with the caveat. Now, this, we kind of blew out all the ties. We didn't want to do just one tie game tonight, right? So we did all of them at once, right? We've gone through all the tie games in one big shot. And I'm going to ask you one more question about it in just a second, but I want to remind our listeners, if you have a game that's presumably, because there aren't any ties left now, thank goodness, and we're not going to do any losses. I don't want to do a loss. So if there's a win out there that you want us to cover in depth, like we've been doing, it has to be prior to our show coming on the air in 2012. So any time from basically 1981, 82 up through 2011. John, I did, because you and I were busy and not really able to do a show last week, and I wanted the listeners to get material. I did go ahead and post the relevant part of our 2013 Texas A&M game. So we've kind of, because we did have a show then, and I thought that would be a fun one to kind of go back to the first really exciting win that we had after our show was on the air. So I don't know if you noticed, I posted that.
I did. I like that one.
Good. And I posted Reynolds Wolf talking about Pat Dye, which I thought was cute. I had a good segment. I can't remember if I used it or not in the show, in the We Believed, but I thought it was just good enough to put out like 2 minutes of Reynolds. Just, Reynolds is very eloquent about things like that and anything else. And it was just cool. So I put that out there. And I also went ahead and posted the complete uncut, for the first time, Hard Fighting Soldiers, Auburn 2004 through 2008. So that, and I want to point out, if you go to www.auwishbone.com, all of the first 7 episodes of We Believed are all permanently linked there with little players. So you can go there and play any of the first seven. Episode 8 is out there. That's the one with Cam Newton in the national championship season. That one's out there, but it's right now it is only for the patrons. So if you are a patron, go to patreon.com to our page. Look, just search Van Plexico and White Rocket, and you can listen to episode 8, which is about the Chizik era and Cam and Nick Fairley. We've already recorded episode 9, and I'll be getting to work on that one pretty soon. And we just have one more left to record, John. Can you believe that? Of the We Believed? I mean, we've been working on this for a couple of years now. So
that's a lot of content.
It really is. I just wanted to have something really neat that we could give our patrons first, and then of course let everybody else listen to, you know, relatively soon after. And that's what we've been kind of parceling them out. They take a lot of work. They take a long time to produce. They are a lot of work, but they are, I think they're worth it. And we're working on 2 books about them too, which is really cool. We're about 60% of the way done with that too, which is awesome. So, okay. So my last question for you, we'll wrap up with this, is what is your feeling about tie games, and are you glad overtime came along, or is it taking something away from college football?
I'm glad that overtime is here. I think it really adds something, and overtime is very exciting.
It is.
I mean, I think about that LSU Texas A&M overtime game a year or two ago that was just bonkers at the end of the year. So I don't ever want to have an overtime game against Alabama.
We almost did. We came so close.
I know we did. I don't want to have an overtime game against Alabama.
I don't think my heart could take it. I think that would be I think that would be on my like cause of death. Some people would be like heart attack. Some people would say, cancer. And yeah.
Where is the soundboard? This is the big one.
I had to find. Remember, I redid it, so all those old ones are kind of hard to find now. But no, I mean, I think that my cause of death.
Oh, it's the worst one. This is the big one. You hear that, Elizabeth? I'm coming to join you, honey.
Yeah, I think that my cause of death would be listed as Auburn, as Iron Bowl overtime. That's what it would just say. Iron. He died of IBO. Iron Bowl overtime. And anybody that knew would be like, they would be nodding sagely like, oh, yes. I've heard that can be deadly. Yes, I'm very sorry to hear that. So, yeah, I agree. I think that overtime in college football is just the coolest thing ever, unless it's you. You know what I mean? It's really fun to watch anybody else do it. But when it's you, it's like Russian roulette, isn't it? I mean, it really is like Russian roulette. Mm-hmm. You're passing that pistol back, you're passing that gun back and forth. So, okay. But ties were weird, as we've discussed tonight. So, all right. Any final thoughts before we wrap up for tonight?
No, but just it's a different era. A different time. Football was, lower scoring. Ties were seen as okay. Mm-hmm. I think that's the other thing, is I think there's a much more of like a we need to win kind of attitude in college football, and I think people would not look at ties as okay the way they did back then.
Yeah, I think if we still had ties today, the people that do stuff like the playoff rankings and all, they wouldn't have a clue what to do with them. They'd be like, how do I count that?
Yeah.
Because it's just not something that's part of the game anymore. It's really strange that it's gone. It's like a big thing that's gone. So, well, that's cool. All right. Well, I guess we will be back in a week or two. Don't worry. If we don't do another live, quote-unquote, live show next Monday, I'll dig around and find something to entertain you, I promise. But one way or the other, we will be back, and we'll have a new flashback game for you to enjoy. So otherwise, I guess our time is up. We thank you for yours. War Eagle, John.
War Eagle, man.
Thanks for listening to the AU Wishbone. Find links to everything we do at www.auwishbone.com. For more Auburn fun, join us on Twitter at @AUWishbone and at facebook.com/AUWishbone. War Eagle.
The AU Wishbone is produced by Van Allen Plexico and John Ringer. Copyright 2020.
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Thank you for listening to the AU Wishbone Podcast.